Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, everyone. This is Susan Thompson of Colgate University. I'm a host on the New Books Network and African Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Thanks for tuning in. Today, it's my honor to welcome Dwayne Jethro of the University of Cape Town. He's written a terrific book titled Heritage Formation in the Senses in Post-Apartheid South Africa, Aesthetics of Power. In his book, Dwayne develops a novel analytical framework to understand the relationship between the senses and heritage formation. And he means by the senses the traditional Western ones: taste, smell, sight, hearing, and touch. He takes us through South Africa's process of heritage formation to show us how the senses are intimately linked as foundational to not only nation building, but how to understand nation building through a material culture. What I loved about Dwayne's study is its interdisciplinary nature and the way in which it makes important contributions to new fields such as sensory studies and memory studies, and the material turn in the humanities and social sciences, but also more quote unquote traditional fields such as anthropology and my own discipline, peace and conflict studies. Dwayne, welcome.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's an honor to be featured on the podcast today.
Thank you. So just to get us started, can you introduce yourself to our listeners with an emphasis on how you came to write such a wonderful book?
Thank you. My name is Dwayne Jethro. I'm currently based at the Center for Curating the Archive at the University of Cape Town. I'm a junior research fellow here. Prior to this position, I was a researcher at the Center for Anthropological Research on Museums and Heritage at the Humboldt University, Berlin. I worked with Professor Sharon MacDonald and a wonderful team of researchers there. Prior to that, I had a postdoc at the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative at the University of Cape Town, so I've been traveling quite a bit. And prior to that postdoc, I was on my PhD. I was busy doing my PhD. Graduated with my PhD in 2015. Defended my dissertation at the University of Utrecht. My supervisors were Professor Birgit Meyer and Professor David Chittister. So the book actually is it's an evolution of the PhD project itself, which looked at, simply put, heritage formation and nation building in post-apartheid South Africa. So my PhD dissertation attempted to look at how new heritage was being made in the post-apartheid dispensation and how that invention of new heritage or the identification of new heritage was being coupled to and enlisted as part of the project of reconciliation and nation building, bringing South Africans together after apartheid and in the shadow of colonialism. So some of the work, the main, in some senses, the main structure of the book actually emerges out of that out of that dissertation, but it's two very different projects. They may look similar, but they're two very different projects.
I read them as quite different, actually. So I haven't read your dissertation, obviously, but it didn't read to me like a dissertation project. It felt rooted in the literature. It's, you know, how PhDs have a particular framework that you need to meet to, like, quote unquote, pass. I think the book didn't have that structure for me. What I loved about it was its storytelling. You're such a natural storyteller, and that came through, I think, in your anthropological sensibility. But before we get into those stories, just because we are going to share your podcast with individuals beyond South Africa and beyond the African continent more broadly, I know my American colleagues struggle to understand what is heritage. It's not a concept that we have really in the literature here. And we also sometimes don't always know, unless you're in museum studies or art history, any sort of conceptual understanding of material culture. Could you explain those two fields of study before we get into the meat, quote unquote?
It's such a basic but such an important and substantive question. What is heritage? So I think my book is making a set of propositions about what heritage actually is. In heritage studies literature, you find a stream of approaches that address heritage as that which comes from the past, typically buildings, so an inherited material culture, stuff that you can see, feel, and touch. So, like, and often stuff that has a very clear visual patina of being old. So it's inherited material, typically buildings. But can extend to a range of commonsensical forms of material culture, like objects that you find in museums also. So it's materially based, identified and recognized as being old, and most especially worth preserving for the future. So these are the basic terms of ordinary, commonsensical, very open-ended, and widely understood definition of what heritage is. But we can extend that to encompass things that are what in the literature are sometimes referred to as intangible cultural heritage. These are practices, oral traditions, dance and ritual, that aren't textualized in the same way as Western forms of knowledge. And these can also be considered a form of heritage because they are part of a lived tradition of a people, and they are essential to the perpetuation of that culture into the future. So they can also be considered to be forms of heritage. My personal position is that heritage is that which is identified as being worth commemoration. That identification takes place in the present, and that identification always has some kind of material reference. So even if it is an oral performance, that oral performance requires bodies to actually perform that oral performance and to receive that. So there's always, for me personally, there's always some kind of material dimension that makes what is claimed to be heritage legible in some way, so that people can perceive it and understand it as being legible. And I think that's one of the propositions that percolates in the book, the legibility, the material legibility that is of heritage claims, that is made sensible, that is understood through practices of claim making and positioning.
Now, I love your answer because it leads us to, I think, your subtitle, Aesthetics of Power. And you do provide a really rich theorization, I think, of the aesthetics of power and its subconcepts in your telling of the aesthetics of authentication and the aesthetics, the aesthetics of persuasion. And I was particularly struck by your analysis of how these two go together to help understand not only heritage formation and the ways in which material culture play into nation building processes around heritage, heritage as an important factor in that sense, but also laying the groundwork for the senses as a way to understand how the government or the nation appeals to the senses to justify its heritage formations. That's why I found the theory there was so compelling. And I think readers will be richly rewarded for a careful read of your introduction. And that leads me to my next question. You take this sense-based framework. How are senses central to the nation building? Like this is, you know, you said commonsensical. Of course, we all have senses in some way. It may be, you know, you could see in the American context, it might be considered ableist, but that would be an unfair critique, I think. How are the senses central to the nation building project in the South African context?
Thanks for the question, Susan. Just to step back a little bit to orientate our readers and to orientate our listeners. In my book, I take this open-ended approach to heritage as being founded on notions of authenticity and notions of aesthetics as well. And authenticity is always in play when heritage claims are being made, because heritage is oftentimes a truth-claiming discourse. Heritage is essentially a truth-claiming discourse. It's a founding discourse. It's because it is so appropriate. When you claim something as your heritage, you claim it as your own.
Right.
And you are staking a legitimate claim to that, and you're also staking a claim to the legitimacy of that form that you are actually making a claim to. I situate that claim-making process in literature that shows that authenticity itself is itself an unstable category.
Mm-hmm.
And it's precisely because authenticity is an unstable category which makes heritage such an interesting discourse to follow when it comes to all kinds of social contestation. The aesthetic I mobilize to foreground the lived experience and the encounters with material cultural forms that are claimed as heritage, to speak to the affordances that these forms have that sometimes go far beyond the claims that different stakeholders actually make. Sometimes these affordances are surprising and unexpected, and they lead to all kinds of excesses that that make these forms even more compelling as heritage forms. So to return to the question of the senses and its centrality to the nation building project, my book tracks five different case studies of five distinct heritage projects. The trajectory of the book is from the state-driven Freedom Park heritage project to the entrepreneurial market-driven project driven by and developed by Jan Scannell, who branded himself Jan Braai. Within this trajectory, I have five different case studies,
mm-hmm.
five distinct projects mapped according to the five different senses. A colleague of mine said that this should be the model for all books going forward: five chapters, five senses, five chapters. So, in any case, the argument I make is that the senses are central to legitimating the claims that are being made in these distinctive, each one of these distinctive heritage products. Sometimes the senses are invoked explicitly, but oftentimes they are implicit to the heritage claim-making process.
Right.
So for example, we find that in chapter four, which addresses the Vuvuzela, for example, the construction of the Vuvuzela, especially during the 2010 World Cup, The sound of the vuvuzela, which is indistinct, it's a braying sound. It doesn't contain any distinct aesthetic value to it. But it was precisely because the sound was so polarizing, as you either liked it or you didn't like it.
Right.
And in the context of the World Cup, that set of debates simply fueled and added to the narratives that were being crafted by the state and football officials that this was an authentic, that this was an authentic African heritage form. Because, I mean, all heritage forms work like that, right? Like you either agree that it is a heritage form or it's not. And
right.
It's going to help substantiate that kind of claim making. It also goes to show how limited the frame of debate and disputation is, because the sound didn't allow for nuance or for any other kind of alternate argument about different possibilities of the authenticity of this. So, in effect, using that example and other example. Other examples that come up throughout the book, we see that the senses either implicitly or sometimes explicitly bind and galvanize the nation. And in the South African context, it was that explicit claim was often made that heritage was about the nation rather than being framed and pitched at smaller scales of collectivities. Although in chapter two, we had discussed a series of memorials that were vandalized. Those memorials were developed for a kind of local collectivity, but they definitely were tied into a kind of national narrative of the overcoming of the struggles of apartheid and commemorating heroes who had been overlooked by the state. So there was such an overemphasis on this national narrative that heritage discourses needed to be pitched within that frame of reference in order for them to be intelligible and in order for them to have traction as well. And the senses were crucial to making those kinds of footholds amongst the different audiences to pitch to.
I love that answer, and it leads me perhaps, it's a good time to hear some of your stories. One thing that is so great about the anthropology of your book is your ability to take the reader along. So when I was reading it, I had this feeling like, oh, I'm on Duane's shoulder and I'm going along and I'm visiting Freedom Park, or I'm sitting on the bench outside the courthouse in Cape Town and I can smell the smells of District 6. Is there an excerpt you would like to read from the book for us to give a reader a sense of the depth of your stories? I was thinking perhaps something from chapter 3 or maybe from Jan Bry. Jan Bry, I think, was my favorite chapter, also because Desmond Tutu appreciates T-bone steaks because they are in the shape of Africa. The best lines in an academic book ever.
Yeah, Desmond Tutu. He genuinely did say that.
Yes. I don't know if you have something you'd like to share with listeners, just to give some.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite passages that I enjoyed writing, and like sometimes there's a passage of writing that you just keep going back to, you keep returning to it. It's so evocative for you. And I think the little introduction for chapter 3, Fragrances and Forced Removal, in that chapter, I track smell and references to aroma in biographies of communities that were forcibly removed in Cape Town, specifically District 6, but other communities as well. And I track and locate them in place and how the sense of smell conceptually works to structure a sense of kind of productive nostalgia in some way. And I make this case for, by using these examples, I make this case for the conceptual possibilities of the sense of smell. And the introduction for that book was, it was kind of crucial for me. Like these little vignettes, each chapter starts off with some kind of small vignette. And these vignettes were really important for anchoring the kinds of stories I wanted to convey and also the themes that were percolating in that chapter. So I'll just read the little vignette that starts off the chapter on fragrances and force removal.
Page 71, eh?
Yeah, I'll read page 71 to the top of page 73. So like one and a half pages.
Perfect. Thank you.
One of the first things I did after relocating to Berlin in 2017 was put up a black and white poster of a mid-century scene from my hometown, Cape Town. It features a nattily dressed gentleman in the company of two women engulfed by flowers. There are flower sellers sitting in Adderley Street in the heart of Cape Town. The image is a strong reminder of the inner city flower market, situated in a shaded alley brimming with colorful flowers and cooling scents that cut through the hot, smoggy inner city air. Yet it wasn't the contents of the image that held my attention so intensely. The print had a backstory that made the sweet-smelling nostalgia it triggered much more poignant. The print was one of a series of flower sellers and the history of flower selling in the city produced by historian Melanie Bowie, who designed them using photographs recovered from archives in Cape Town. Working with contemporary flower sellers, Bowie curated the prints and a series of postcards into an exhibition experiment called Cape Town Floriography. Launched on Heritage Day 2016, the prints were distributed amongst flower sellers to use as wrapping, which effectively and purposefully changed the cycle of using waste newsprint for the same purpose. Setting the images of the history of flower selling into circulation on Heritage Day, the Cape Town Floriography Project asserted the social significance, indeed the heritage significance, of the flower sellers in the city by drawing on the fleeting materiality of the print culture essential to their trade. I would sometimes turn to my print for inspiration when trying to think about smell, nostalgia, and forced removal. In doing so, I often grappled with what appeared to be one of the image's central contradictions, that it depicted a scene of traders who circulated the scent and color of flowers in the city center, but as black and colored traders, they experienced racial discrimination that forced them to live at its periphery. How can we reconcile the senses and the sense of smell in particular with the urban experience of displacement? So from there onwards, I start delving into the theory,
yep.
which I would invite your readers to and your listeners to check out for themselves. But that little vignette was really crucial for me. And at the end of that chapter, I'll just read because I tie the chapter up with that opening vignette. So I'll just jump to the end of the chapter and read you that first little paragraph there. So my print from the Cape Town Floriography Project hung on my wall for about a year, prompting fragrant memories of home. Over time, however, it took on a brownish-yellow patina, as if the paper had aged out of sympathy for the characters mm-hmm. pictured in the old scene. This chapter has in some ways been an attempt to come to terms with an apparent tension in this image, between the central place of flower sellers and ordinary black working class people like them, having historically been pushed from the center to the margins of the city. In many ways, I've tried to make sense of this tension through consideration of the role of memories of smell and aroma, through a consideration of the role memories of smell and aroma played in black working class communities, making sense of apartheid era forced displacement. So you can see like these little vignettes were really important for my thinking through and for working through what I consider to be the central issues percolating in each one of the chapters, and that was one that really stuck with me. That poster really did evoke a very strong sense of nostalgia in me, and it was the kind of nostalgia that I think opened me up to the kind of identifications that were being made by the interlocutors that I cite in that chapter.
Is that sense of nostalgia central to a sense framework?
I think the sense of nostalgia is very strongly related to the sense of smell and aroma. Cultural studies literature, sensory study literature backs it up quite strongly. More than any other sensory modality, the sense of smell is a potent trigger for nostalgia. And in that chapter, I was working through what nostalgia actually is and what the potential of nostalgia, the potentialities of nostalgia. Because nostalgia, the etymology of the word nostalgia is a longing for home, essentially. So it's a longing to be back home. It's not just the longing for a better time or a better place, but it is connected to the idea of home. And so that chapter was working through a kind of nostalgia, but nostalgia doesn't necessarily percolate or emerge and arise in the other chapters. Although at a conceptual level, and we can have a conversation about it, at a conceptual level, in some ways the kind of past that was being imagined through this nation building and reconciliation framework that the state had set up, that kind of past was very nostalgic. It was nostalgic in the sense of being idealistic. And there's a fragility to nostalgia that is related to the substantive circumstance of how nostalgia actually arises. Insofar as you can only be nostalgic for something that you do not have.
Right.
So nostalgia is always aspirational. And that's what makes nostalgia the fragility of nostalgia is it can be really productive to work with and to think with it. And what sets up the brittleness that makes nostalgia so potent in a particular circumstance.
Does your rendering of nostalgia make it something unique to your study, or can we use nostalgia to explain other forms of nation building in other cases? So that's one question I did have. Is your study unique to South Africa, or is it one that travels, quote unquote, to quote Foucault?
That's a challenging question. I wanted to make a set of claims about what's going on or what had been going on in South Africa at a particular time.
Right.
And I wanted to put those propositions in play as part of a broader international set of conversations about heritage, about the census, about culture. So in some ways, the book is a little bit patriotic, I have to say. I really did want to flag like our problems and our contradictions out here are distinct and unique in ways that you haven't seen before, and I try to profile that. Of course, you run a number of risks by profiling your case studies in that way. I never in any way did I want to profile our case studies as being unique. By that I mean to say that they are incomparable. I think I tried to profile them in the sharpest ways that I could, so that they could be drawn into other conversations.
I think you did that. I work a lot on Rwanda and a little bit on Kenya, and I can imagine using the senses in the way that you describe them to understand, for example, Rwanda's post-genocide reconciliation project. So they don't use, you don't see in the literature on Rwanda the language of heritage or of material culture, but the government does not impose, but expect, I suppose, a particular kind of embodied response to certain activities related to reconciliation. And you can see that, for example, in Kenya with, memorials for the Mau Mau, for example. And I thought, maybe it is a patriotic study, but that's okay, because you begin to get, for the average reader, someone who may not be familiar with South Africa per se, the value of a sense-based framework in that you, that each chapter is uniquely evocative in the sense that you have vision, you have taste, you have touch. Like the idea of touching newspapers in your Sunday Times chapter, I thought was so compelling. And the overarching conceptual framework for me, and when I teach your book to my students, I use the language of embodiment. Because embodiment is actually really challenging to study because it's so idiosyncratic and subjective. So So if you think a bit deeper and you're like, okay, so what does it mean to have the smell of flowers to understand forced removals through cellars in a city like Cape Town? Like that is actually uniquely positioned to help us understand embodiment beyond the traditional feminist frameworks. I find your work to be decolonial in the sense that we mean it in the West, and to be feminist in the sense that it centers the body without actually centering the body.
Thanks for pulling out those references, Susan. I didn't think about it like that, but the more you prompt me, I think there are possibilities for method here, right? Like for thinking about I wonder what the opposite would be. So how would it be possible to write a book about heritage and the senses if I made no reference to my own experience of these differences? I think it didn't make sense to me as a project without me inserting myself in some way.
Sure.
Stepping out of this the sense of scholarly omnipotence and into spaces of vulnerability at times. I mean, to venture into the kind of nostalgia that I set up in the little reading that I'm provided. To enter into that space of nostalgia is a vulnerable space. It's a space of uncertainty, a space of risk, a scholarly risk, and that goes unannounced. But it was an important risk for that chapter in order to articulate the possibilities of what an engaged sensory studies reading of these phenomena could possibly look like.
Right.
I didn't claim it explicitly like that. Either in the introduction or the conclusion, but books are funny things. You can
that's true.
Go back to them and you can go back to them and see things in them. I was really making that kind of argument. So I think there are grounds for this idea of method to charge for our students to add a little bit of themselves, especially. And bring themselves in, especially in contexts and cases and research fields that require this kind of phenomenological reflection that can actually drive and lift the field.
Yeah, and it can act as a hermeneutic, like as an interpretive device.
Our
embodied reactions are part of our findings.
And I think it's more and more important now, especially around and in the field of contested heritage, contested pasts, to foreground your experience of a certain set of phenomena. I don't think it should be the be-all and end-all of the debate. I do think it's really important to flag that and to reflect on that, to add to the broadening and the deepening of a set of conversations.
I think that what makes your study so profound for me is that senses are cultural, senses are place-based, and yet at the same time, they're completely universal because we all have some experience of them. And I think it does provide a way for researchers to be more reflective about whatever study they might be pursuing, not just something specific to heritage or something specific to the senses. So with that comment in mind, did you want to read from chapter 5? I must say Bri Day was so outlandish, but yet so tangible. I just love it. It was a great way to end the book, your last substantive chapter before the conclusion.
Thank you so much. I think it was a chapter that was cooking for a long time. In the back of my mind, thinking about my PhD dissertation, because it was such a huge phenomenon in South Africa. While I was busy doing my, writing my PhD dissertation, but it was a case study that fell out of the scope of my PhD project. But it was always just there every year, 24th of September, which is South African Heritage Day. There would be this roaring debate in public. We shouldn't refer to the day as National Braai Day. We should refer to the day as National Heritage Day. Huge, 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 huge dispute about this. And it was just, I just kept collecting material on this, and I really wanted to make space to write something about the Braai Day phenomenon. So effectively, just to introduce your readers to the Braai Day phenomenon before I actually get into the case, to reading one or two passages. In 2005, an entrepreneur named Jan Scano, he initiated a kind of spoof movement in South Africa to have this organic celebration of barbecue, what in American Canada is typically referred to as barbecue, but in South Africa we refer to it as braai. And he said, let's come together and let's braai on this particular day, and South Africans can come together and we can get all braai and be patriotic and wave the flag and talk about our heritage. But with each passing year and with the increasing popularity of this event, not only did it become popular amongst retail marketers, it also divided the nation insofar as people started, the South African public really started debating about, so what the hell really is Heritage Day all about? And what is our heritage all about? Like, do we braai or don't we braai? Putting that question on the table, I think, was one of the most important things of that project, the Braai Day project. But I go on to show in the chapter how I illustrate, firstly, how you go about setting up a really popular and really profitable heritage campaign, one that really draws the nation in and one that explicitly references similar national pastimes, invented national pastimes in other parts of the world. So there's a kind of recipe for how to go about it, percolating, or at least simmering in this chapter. And I follow these arguments to illustrate exactly how close marketing rhetorics and heritage discourses actually track each other and weave into each other. And so that at certain points, it becomes very difficult for you to distinguish between whether people are just making this up, or if this really is heritage. So I'll read you a passage. One of the central debates in this whole Braai Day phenomenon was about whether or not the South African word and the tradition of open fire cooking, commonly referred to as barbecue, was South African at all. Like, how do you substantiate that? Like, I mean, everybody does this open fire cooking. How do you substantiate it? And I'll read you a little passage of how this tradition, or at least this cooking method, was substantiated based on the literature that I discovered and looked up.
Thank you.
But what indeed was distinctly South African about braai? Why was it in any way distinct from other traditions of open fire cooking? Indeed, grilling can be seen as a ritual of consumption nations partook in on important commemorative days around the world. For example, barbecue has been described as America's first food and an American institution that was enthusiastically observed on Independence Day on the 4th of July. Grill smoke also envelops Israel's Independence Day celebration. Avieli argues, for example, that barbecuing meat is the main activities for most Israeli Jews celebrating the nation on Independence Day, becoming so central to annual festivities that it has come to be known as Barbecue Day. Continually nominated as a national dish of Australia, the barbecue is held in high esteem and is widely observed on Australia Day when lamb is grilled as the preferred meat. So here we get these global impressions of the significance of barbecue. Braai was distinctly different, at least according to Desmond Tutu, one of Jan Scannell's main supporters.
Sponsors almost.
Yeah. Enthusing about the Braai Day project in 2007, Archbishop Tutu provided a well-thought-through argument about the cultural significance of braai as a distinctly South African cooking method. First, the word braai had a lexical distinctiveness as a singular term that cut across polylingual differences. We have 11 languages, but only one word for this wonderful institution. It's braai. It's braai in Xhosa. It's braai in Afrikaans. It's braai in English. And it's braai in whatever, he said. Significantly, the word braai is itself very young, with one of the first dictionary entries of the word braai, which derives from the Dutch word braden, appearing in a dictionary from 1902. Second, Archbishop Desmond Tutu argued that the braai staged a small-scale sociality that had nation-building potential, saying, quote, "It has fantastic potential to bind us together because all it calls for is to come together with your friends, your family, you have a little fire, and braai." Close quotes. Elaborating on the essence of braai's socially binding potential, Tutu said, "We've shown the world a few things. Let us show them that ordinary activities like eating can unite people of different races, religions, sexes. Short people, tall people, fat people, lean people." Close quotes. In these terms, braai had the potential to unite all of humanity. Finally, Tutu asserted that because of his distinctiveness as a linguistic unifier and a cultural form with real nation-building potential, braaiing was essentially an unrecognized patriotic activity. Open quotes. "Don't do anything else, just braai. I mean, that should make you proudly South African." Close quotes. Braai was thus a linguistic unifier, a nation-building social occasion, and a pride-inducing patriotic ritual activity. In summary then, open quotes, "This Braai Day initiative reflects the spirit of South Africans and embodies the unique methods we employ as a nation to promote democracy, patriotism, and national pride. Promoting braai as advancing democracy, inspiring patriotism and pride, Archbishop Desmond Tutu again affirmed that consumption be the focus of Heritage Day's commemorative activity." So these are the kinds of claims that I was working through in this chapter, illustrating how certain personalities can lend weight to certain claims.
Right.
And provide logics that are intuitively convincing and persuasive and cut very close to official state rhetoric of what the essence of the commemoration of heritage in post-apartheid South Africa actually is, and makes it very difficult for ordinary South Africans to distinguish between whether or not they want to distinguish, of course, for ordinary South Africans, and even readers of my book, to distinguish between, okay, so where does the marketing spiel and the rhetoric end and actual heritage, official heritage discourse is actually begin? And it's that kind of troubling that I was searching for in this chapter.
It's such an interesting chapter too, because it brings in beyond marketing and the relationship between marketing and heritage, which I think is pretty profound, actually. It's a great connection to make, is your identification of a particular brand of masculinity, white masculinity in particular, with some of the images you have in the chapter. I'm particularly struck by the one with Jan Bry standing with indigenous people in Namibia. He found a clever way to market his personality as sort of a South African everyman, and that everymanness seems to be part of the heritage that Bry Day is trying to capture.
And even just writing that, right? Like, I was, the essence of the Bry Day project was exactly as you said. It was a campaign that was meant to reach and speak to the everyman, the ordinary South African. And I show that of all the people to develop a campaign like this, he definitely was not the archetype of the everyman.
That true.
Yeah, he was the opposite of the archetype of the everyman. And so it was impossible for him to hold that claim. And I think that's the fragility of this chapter. So if you read the chapter as a kind of biography project of this entrepreneur, then these images, some of them which are challenging, it's difficult to look at this image of Jan Bry and Figure 5.3. It appears in his cookbook uncommented, like he's standing around with a group of indigenous people. I don't know what the visual communication here is, whether he identifies with them, whether they're trying to make a statement about the traditional origins of this.
Yeah, indigeneity or something.
Yeah, I don't know what this image is supposed to communicate. There was no caption supporting it. But it's problematic being uncontextualized like that. And yet there's a tension in this image insofar as it there's an urgency for this individual. At least that's the way I read it. There's an urgency for this individual and through this project to be able to take up that position of the everyman, that they are able to do that in an unquestioned way. And I think the Bry Day chapter was an interrogation of like, who gets to do that and under what conditions do they get to do that? And ultimately, I show in the conclusion that it's precisely because of the terms in which our reconciliation and nation building narratives were set up that we didn't have a kind of, we had a negotiated settlement. And part of the negotiated settlement was a set of languages that said that there were no winners and there were no losers.
Right.
And it suggested because there were no winners and no losers, everything is possible under nation building and reconciliation rhetoric. And so it allows, in some ways, it allows for that searching for the adoption of an everyman persona, as long as it contributes towards some kind of social good. And I needed to flag that in this chapter, in not for a sense of character assassination.
Right, I agree.
It's not a character assassination. Just to point out that someone is privileged, and who are they to be able to make these kinds of claims? Rather, it was important because firstly, Scannell had inserted his own biography into the story. The project was very much about him. And so if he was putting himself out there, then a biographical reading of who he really was a valid critique. But also a kind of reading of the cultural terms in which he presented himself and the way he wanted to be seen and how that matched up to where he actually came from. I think, I'd never thought about it like that. I hadn't thought about it like that before. It was just in the background.
Interesting, yeah.
And so it just came home to me quite strongly now, thinking about it and looking at it. it is quite ridiculous. But I made a bit of a meal out of it, and I'm glad it sat with you.
Yeah, but I think the absurdity, for lack of a better word, like it's kind of a bizarre thing, because you could situate Bri as embodying all the senses.
Precisely.
Based on which, you know, protein you choose, I guess, like, can you Bri tofu in the South African setting? I'm not sure that's appropriate to the context.
I didn't highlight that in the chapter. I didn't highlight it strongly enough. It's highly gendered rituals.
You did actually capture that, I think. And the picture is so compelling. Oh, speaking over you, I'm sorry.
No, of who gets to handle the meat, who gets to light the fire, who prepares what kinds of dishes, the order of the meal, etc. The domestic space versus outdoor space, all of these are highly gendered. And so the notion of Bri that is developed and advanced in the Bri Day project is a very conservative idea of heteronormativity, of the nuclear family, of the man as the breadwinner, mm-hmm. as a man, tough guy, an outdoors person, and it was a highly, highly gendered culinary practice.
And I think you see that in the image that we just discussed on page 145. Jan is standing there with these indigenous folks from Namibia with his hands on his hips and sort of presenting this like superhero stance in the image. And it's pretty interesting to see him standing, with these individuals without an ounce of context, but still projecting this masculine drive. And it's interesting in Namibia because, of course, South Africa occupied what is present-day Namibia until the 1970s, as you well know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a fantastic image for a visual anthropological analysis. There is so much going on in that image.
Yeah, it's really rich. It's a great image.
A contemporary white South African masculinity, and you can read it against these histories of African occupation, et cetera.
Yeah, for sure. So, Duane, I've kept you for a good long time. So as we begin to wrap up, I want to ask two more questions. Number one, what is your next project? And number two, do you have readings, podcasts, documentaries that you might suggest to readers who wish to dive deeper into your framework and into your research?
My next project is looking at horticulture, botany, and plants in South Africa as an open field mm-hmm. for the negotiation and mediation of notions of the past in the city of Cape Town, looking at a different set of sites and heritage sites in the city. Some sites aren't necessarily explicitly framed as heritage. So it's a little bit of a shift for me, but essentially I am a theorist of the cultural production of heritage and contested public cultures. Those are the two sets of rubrics that I sit with and that interest me. Now I'm applying them in a new setting. Podcasts and other popular, accessible references. I think Africa is a Country, the blog. I've written quite regularly for Africa is a Country. So if you want to access some of my public writing, you can do so there. Not much of it is about the census, but it these are extensions of the kinds of ways I think about contested public health. So the free articles that you're able to access at Africa is a Country. But all of Africa's Country is an amazing resource, and it's an amazing project. Great people working at Africa's Country. The Conversation South Africa is also another source of information, or at least for articles that are public articles that I've written. I've also done a podcast about this book with the historian of science, Edna Bonhom, for a fantastic podcast called Decolonization in Action. I would encourage your listeners to try and access the podcast, Decolonization in Action. You can check it out on Spotify.
Oh, great. Thanks.
That's a wonderful resource, not just for another interview about my book, but also about the wonderful speakers that Edna gets onto her platform.
Wonderful.
Yeah, those are the references that I can suggest for your audience.
Yeah, Duane, thanks for your time today. Is there any final remark or question I didn't ask that you would have liked to have answered? Anything we're missing before we end our time together?
I think it's more and more important to think about heritage and the census, because in these times of the culture wars that are taking place, not only in the US, but in other places, such as the UK, in Germany, where I've worked before also, it's becoming more and more apparent the ways in which the culture wars are filtering into scholarly practice and the way in which our work as scholars, and in the way in which we teach, and the way in which we work with our students. Heritage issues are more and more important, and I think hopefully my book can add to a conversation about the diversity of perceptions of how the past matters for different people, and that's also important, that it is important to recognize that heritage is that which is contested, and the contestation is a good thing. It is a good thing to have fierce debates and struggles about the past. It's healthy and it's important. And to keep an open mind about these things, because it's starting to affect the way colleagues work. It's starting to affect what topics people are allowed to work on. It's affecting how funding is channeled.
Yeah.
Simply based on perceptions of the politicization of what is considered to be heritage and history.
Yeah.
And so it's more and more important to keep these ideas in mind, and to take a position on certain things, and to stand for certain issues in some of these things. So,
I think that's a great way to end, with a reminder that these concepts have practical application, and they affect how we think, how we study, how our work is funded, and so on. Duane, thank you so much. We've been speaking to Duane Drethrow about his new book, Heritage Formation in the Census and Post-Apartheid South Africa.